Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, stress relief coach, emotional wellness speaker, and host of the Mighty Parenting podcast and co-founder of MightyParenting.com. Today, we are talking about raising our boys. In episode 76, we started this discussion. We started talking about how raising boys is different. And a lot of that discussion tended to center around school and learning. Well, today we're continuing that conversation, but we have a different angle. Today we're going to look at different issues such as maybe our boys' silence and rage, talking with them about puberty, and what happens when we don't talk to our boys and as a culture don't talk about what's happening with them. Joining us to help us with that is Kara Natterson. Kara is a pediatrician who has expanded the scope of her work to give parents the time and attention their family doctor or pediatrician may not be able to give. So, in addition to being a pediatrician, she is a consultant and New York Times bestselling author of puberty and parenting books. And her newest book, which we're going to be referencing quite a bit today, is Decoding Boys, New Science Behind the Subtle Art of Raising Sons. Kara, welcome to Mighty Parenting.
Well, thank you for having me.
As I was reading your book, I got so excited about having this conversation with you. Now, my listeners know I am the parent of two daughters. I do not have parenting experience with this. I am married to a man who has three brothers, and they also have some boys. So on the outskirts, I've seen some of this, but I've had some conversations with other parents and other parenting experts who have alluded to some of the things that you said, that, you know, there are definite things going on here. And so I'm curious, from your standpoint, what prompted you to write Decoding Boys?
Well, it all started when I started writing body books for kids, actually. I write a series for American Girl called The Care and Keeping of You, which is a girl body book series. And from day one, I begged American Girl to let me write a boy body book because I didn't really see a big difference as a pediatrician between the puberty experience for girls and for boys. It's all about transformation. And so, yeah, there's some physical differences, but the vast majority of experiences are independent of gender. And so eventually American Girl got behind that idea, and we launched a book called Guy Stuff. And it was during the process of writing Guy Stuff, when my own son was entering the tween years, that I became acutely aware in a really different way than I ever had before of how different the parenting landscape is for parents of girls and parents of boys. And the reason it became clear is as I started traveling with my books and talking to families all over, I realized that The Care and Keeping was really a conversation starter in a way that Guy Stuff, I was having to prompt parents and push them to use it as a conversation starter. And the most common refrain I would get is, they don't want to talk. And I was experiencing it in my own home. I have a daughter as well. And you know, it's not that all boys are one way and all girls are another by any stretch, but the stereotypical experience was bearing out in my house, where my daughter felt very empowered to talk about what was happening to her physically, emotionally, socially. My son really retreated and he got increasingly quiet. He liked shutting his door. He liked his privacy. He liked his quiet. And I sort of went along with the social norm of saying, oh, that's what boys do. And it took me being on the road with this book and talking to hundreds of parents to say, wait a second, we shouldn't approach our boys so differently than we approach our girls, because we have empowered our girls with language and voice in a way that I don't think we are empowering our boys. And ultimately, I think it's a real disservice to them. And when you do start talking to them, they actually start talking back, not talking back, but talking back to us So that's the sort of long version of how I ended up down this road.
What's really interesting to me in what you said is that is a complaint that parents have about teens in general, but more so about boys is, oh, they're quiet. They don't want to talk to me. But the interesting thing is what I heard was we've set up societal expectations and we have not empowered our boys. And that's part of what's causing the silence. So there's actually like something we can do about it besides having to try to change our kids.
Oh, that's right. You know, I think the way I have always framed it is we as a society have done a really good job over the past couple of decades of giving our girls louder and louder voice. So let's do the same for our boys. It just doesn't make sense why we don't. And in a world of Me Too and online porn and gun violence and these issues that are very, very serious and have major consequences for them, how are we not empowering them with conversation after conversation after conversation?
Exactly. It's one of the things that, as I said, I'm a parent of daughters, but in some ways that made me more aware as I started doing interviews and talking to more experts and more parents was that I kept hearing, well, this impacts girls like this. And this is a problem for girls because, and that's when I started really talking to the experts and going, and what about our boys? Like body image issues was a big one. I hear about it all the time in terms of girls, but as far as I can tell, there are just as many messages for boys in our culture about body image. It's just a different message, but it's still about what you should look like. And then of course that goes into how a quote unquote man should behave.
I think body image is a phenomenal example because, you know, when I was in medical school, we were taught that 10% of body dysmorphia and eating disorders were male and 90% were female. And that's still generally considered the truth, if you will. But the data shows something very different. It shows that 50% of body dysmorphia is male, that boys struggle just as much as girls struggle. It's just that we have labeled body dysmorphia and body image issues as female. And in fact, by doing that, we have quieted our boys even more because not only do they have, some of them have issues around how their body looks, but they feel that they have an issue that's not appropriate to them. And so this shames them a little bit. The standards for boy body image are tremendous. I mean, head to toe, boys have a checklist of the way that they are supposed to look by the time they are done with puberty that is as overwhelming, if not more so, than the checklist for girls. And I think as I've looked at trends over the past decade or so, I think as a society, we've really moved beyond our one archetype of female beauty, and we have now embraced different definitions of what it is to have a beautiful body as a female. That's taken a lot of work as a society. We're not done. We have a long ways to go, but we're doing better. We have not done that for males. And the reason why is we just don't talk about it. We just don't think of male body image as an issue.
So I'm curious if that partly comes from, again, a societal trend in general that women do tend to be more conversation oriented. So the moms get together and talk about things, but that's not as much of a dad thing, at least my understanding. And I know, like, I've talked to someone who ran retreats and they're like, oh yeah, the women, we can just sit you guys down in chairs and talk to you and talk with you. But the guys, we got to come up with a project. Cause if we don't have a project, we can't get them talking. We can't get them to do anything. And so I'm wondering if some of our problem in opening up this conversation for boys is that really we need to find a way to also open it up for men who grew up with these same problems. They also were in some sense silenced.
100%. I think there are multiple factors at play here. One of them is most certainly that the dads of today were raised in a time when no one ever talked to boys. And, you know, my husband always describes this. He shut his door for 4 years and he emerged out the other end. He's a very articulate and thoughtful and sensitive guy. He thinks he's fine. So why should you worry? Right. That is, I think that that really has been sort of a deep-seated belief for most men, because they do enter this phase of quiet and then they do by and large exit it. They, you know, yes, sometimes they need more prompting, but they also, once prompted, will open up. And so there are lots of layers here, right? There's a layer of why did they get quiet in the first place and what has happened to them? What has happened to the dads of who, when, you know, they went through their puberty 10, 20, 30 years ago? And then what is the anticipation for their sons as their sons go through it now? And then there's the layer of, well, if I'm going to be fine anyways, and I'm going to come out the other end and be more verbal and be more vocal, why should we pathologize something that is seems normal? And my argument is this, it's not that it's not anticipated or normal for some people, regardless of their gender, to want to retreat for a little while and be quiet. However, we see a trend among boys as they are going through puberty where they more often than not want to pull back out of conversations, out of situations, out of whatever issue is circulating at home. And these very boys are being raised in a world where there are so many pitfalls that did not exist a generation ago that can really have long-term consequences for them, that it's just not fair to them to let them retreat and anticipate that they're going to emerge unscathed. They've got phones and laptops and social media and text and email and image and written content that can be forwarded indefinitely. The things that were happening a generation, two generations, three generations ago, as men in their lives went through this exact same period, were the world was different. The variables were different. The levers were different. So we live in this world where you have a boy retreating behind a closed door, and he's not just retreating behind a closed door. He may be behind a closed door with an entire world at his fingertips. And what boys do in that context with their developing brains and their, you know, largely impulsive brains, because the impulsive limbic system, the feel good risk reward part of the brain dominates in the teen years, as we all know. You know, what then happens when we leave them and we don't engage them in conversations that outline the consequences of some of the behaviors they may engage in? It's just not fair for us to pretend that those pieces are not in place now. Does that make sense?
That makes so much sense, because it was so funny as you were talking, I was like, and you were talking about what the last generation of men experienced. And I was like, okay, so really, if this is normal and they like to retreat, why not let them do that? And your answer is so enlightening. And it's so interesting to me because, as you said, physiologically, their brains are not designed to be left alone at this point without causing problems. Between the lack of reasoning and the incredible dominance of the limbic brain, it's just too much for them to handle. And they can't understand why that's a problem either. So before we get back into kind of our bigger picture of talking to our boys and things, does it make more sense when parents have boys in their household or kids in general? Because, you know, obviously to some degree this applies to girls as well and possibly in different ways too. But does it make sense to say, like, no devices in the bedrooms, so that the kids have a place that they can go, so they can retreat to be alone, but it is actually time to themselves and time where they can process and deal with whatever their thoughts and feelings are, but without that input of a teenage world and media?
So every family is going to do this differently. Every child is different. Every parent is different. Every child-parent dynamic is different. The circumstances of every given home are different. Certainly the circumstances of the world we're living in currently with coronavirus and the requirement that so many kids stay home all day, every day is different. And this is a new variable. I think it's very hard to give categorical advice here about devices in a room. But here's what I will say. It makes good common sense that if someone wants privacy with their thoughts, or privacy with a book, or privacy with a journal, then having a phone or a laptop or an iPad that can distract them and take them down various rabbit holes, that could take them down various rabbit holes, right? So it is probably, for parents who are looking for this guidance, it is probably better to say, let's limit the devices in the room. That is advice that is easier to enforce, and I think more important for younger kids. I think as kids get older, especially in the teens and early 20s, I think device management and learning self-regulation on devices is probably the most critical skill that they can have. And again, in different homes, it's going to play out different ways. So some parents are going to be able to say, hey, let's not have devices in the room. And some parents are not. The most important thing you can do, regardless of your child's age, gender, anything, is to explain your rationale. This is why you have to have conversations with your kids. If you just say no devices in the room, that's fine. That'll work in some families. But if you say, look, I don't want any devices in your room because I feel like sometimes you just need to go to your room and shut your door and be on your own. And I feel like if you've got a phone in there, you're just going to be on that phone and it's not going to give you the moment that you need to process the thoughts and to figure out where your head is. So that's why I'm saying, please, no devices in the room. If you give them the rationale, they can be annoyed with the rule, but at least they'll take your rationale with them and it'll make more sense to them. And one day they'll actually be able to apply your rationale and go, huh, maybe I shouldn't have the device in my room because maybe I need to be alone with my thoughts for a little bit. And I know when my phone's here, I just pick up my phone. So I don't care if your child is 6, 16, 26, doesn't matter to me. Always give a rationale for why you are making a suggestion or imposing a rule.
That really works well. And especially as they're getting older. And one of the things we encourage in Mighty Parenting is, yes, having conversations, but also brainstorming and working things out with kids. You know, you mentioned that we're recording this interview when as many states have just begun or a short time ago begun what people are calling lockdown procedures, but stay home, stay safe procedures and things like that. And prior to that point, a week before that, where I'm at, when it was still just, hey, we want some social distancing, you know, the first few days of that, we had conversations about that. And our family didn't see eye to eye on it. But because my husband and I sat down with our two girls and we had that conversation together, we're able to do some back and forth and listen to their viewpoints. And they heard ours and we kind of went through and went, okay, well, this is where we agree. This is where we disagree. And here is our compromise and what we're actually going to do. And you know, the compromise at the moment was, okay, I have been gone for a long time. I have one friend who I haven't seen. And it was, okay, we're going to meet outside and stay 6 feet apart outdoors so that we can see each other once. And, you know, we kind of went, okay, you know, that works. But I can see the same thing happening with this. If a parent may feel that, you know, this is in a sense a safety concern. So I am drawing this line and saying this is the rule and this is the rationale. But I can also see those conversations, and particularly when you get into the 20 somethings range, right? And the closer you get to that, is doing the back and forth, telling them this is what I see and what my concerns are. What do you think about that? Or how do you see that? And let that go with some back and forth and come up with a plan together on what you think will work. And it might be that in your family, you say nobody has devices in their rooms. including mom and dad, like this is our retreat space. Or maybe everyone says, you know, we really need to be able to, that's where we do our homework. That's where we do all kinds of things. We really want our devices in there. Maybe we're going to, as a family, set up another space in our house that anybody could use, that they can go in and shut the door, but it is a device-free zone. And it's a place where we can, any of us could get away and get away from the world to be alone with our thoughts, or as you said, you know, our journal, or you know, or a good book, or whatever it is that we want to do. And I like that you're recognizing that it's different as our kids get older.
I really like your phrase "compromise of the moment," because I think so much of parenting revolves around the fact that the situation changes. Our kids get older, their brains mature, their bodies change, their friends change, their ability to manage situations changes. And so great parenting one day might be stale parenting the next. And so I love that phrase, because I think being fluid in our parenting, acknowledging, you know, when it's time to make a shift, is wonderful.
We're having this conversation, and one of the things I'm thinking of is, this is all very nice and logical and calm, and we all know that life with kids is not always calm. And in particular, I know you talked about in your book, you did such a beautiful job of explaining things in your book and going through both the physical and the other emotional types of issues. And one of the things that happens is the silence that we talk about, of our boys being quiet, and, you know, we need to start opening up with them and with their fathers and things like that. But there's also the opposite of that, and we can get hit with our kids' rage, our boys' rage. Would you enlighten us a little bit about that whole situation, like what it is and why it's happening? And then I'd like to discuss how we can handle that, because all these ideas that we're giving, I'm like, if your child's raging, this isn't going to work.
So absolutely. Just 30 seconds on why we even divide kids by gender in terms of their emotional experience through puberty. It's not that there aren't girls who experience rage. There are plenty. It's not that there aren't boys who stay chatty through the entire process. There are plenty. But the hormones that drive girl puberty, namely estrogen, tend to have a certain impact on the brain that is slightly different than the hormones that drive male puberty. And that's the number one hormone there is testosterone. And we know a lot about testosterone and rage. There have been many, many studies in all different settings that look at how when testosterone levels are high, are chronically high, are surging, that so often this goes along with either physical violence or outbursts of some sort, verbal, emotional. And we know that, again, it really depends on your brain type and your brain chemistry and your temperament. But we know that the hormone testosterone, which is in charge of making boys mature into reproductively mature men, that same hormone is also responsible for behaviors in the brain that we often label as rageful or aggressive. What hasn't been studied as much is this opposite pendulum swing, which is the quiet. I do think rage and quiet are two sides of the same coin. And I do think that as people start to study testosterone effects in the brain without looking just at anger and rage, but when they look at other emotions, I think what you're going to find is that you're going to be able to correlate the testosterone levels with where you are on this spectrum of sort of quiet to angry. And I think that's going to be important, because I think the more information we have about the biology of how we feel, the more we can then kind of feel a sense of control and we can actually do something about it. So that's the background as to why we always talk about this rage. We do see it sometimes in boys. A lot of people have written me since the book has come out who study boys. And one of the most interesting comments I have gotten, and I've gotten this from a number of people who work with boys, is that they feel that It is not just testosterone, but it is the testosterone met with the social isolation of boys. And that social isolation then creates emotional isolation. And it is that sort of toxic stew that is really responsible for some of the frightening aggression that we see, maybe, you know, with physical violence and gun violence and things like that. And there are papers written about this, and there are people who are studying it. This is the nature of having chemicals that float around our body that are in charge of changing parts, but also happen to float around our brain and have very real neurochemical effects.
So when we're living with these boys, what I'm getting from this is that a lot of their rage, this is just a chemical situation, a short-term chemical situation, but it's something that physiologically they can't change. So it would be up to us as parents to give them tools to help manage that or direct it. Would that be what we can do for them?
I mean, listen, you've raised two girls. I have a girl living in my house. For sure, we have experienced a version of this from our daughters that is different, but we have said to our girls, you have to manage this emotional swing. And these are the reasons why you have to manage it. Rage is no different, right? So this swing that we see with boys, to teach them that there is a chemical in their body that has very profound effects. And when they begin to feel this way, unless they figure out a different outlet, they could end up going down a certain path that leads them into, you know, to a very dire consequence. If they use physical aggression to solve a problem, the consequences are steep, right? So that is how we need to parent boys and girls, is to point out why they need to manage the behavioral impulses they may have. And I think it's going to be, again, different for every kid in every family. And there are certainly some boys out there who parents would say, I just don't need to have this conversation with my son. He's just not wired this way. Okay. Parents know their kids best, but testosterone is a powerful drug.
Interesting. Interesting choice of words. Why do you call it a powerful drug?
Well, because it is. Because, you know, just because our bodies make it, and female bodies make testosterone too, but just because our bodies make it, doesn't mean it isn't a potent substance. It's potent. And so just like everything else in parenting requires pivoting, sometimes parents will be so sure that they have a certain kind of kid. And then one day or one week, they suddenly have a different kind of kid in their home. And they need to pivot the way they approach that child. And sometimes it's because something's happening inside that child's body or mind. And sometimes it's because kids are putting something into their body and that's what's impacting them. But testosterone, whether it's made by us or whether it's made by a pharmaceutical company, is a powerful drug. And I will add that, you know, I write a lot about this. There's so much pressure for boys about how to look through puberty and that back end of puberty and how to change their body to meet certain body ideals, that a huge percentage of boys will take supplements and with the goal of shifting the way their body looks. And among those are prescription drugs that boys get their hands on. And in that group, we certainly hear about anabolic steroids, but we also hear about testosterone being abused by boys. So there is, you know, testosterone is a powerful drug.
Interesting. So if we have a boy who is already experiencing rage, or maybe we have one who hasn't, and we just want to have a proactive conversation and go, it doesn't look to me like you've been struggling with anger or rage, but it's something that can happen commonly as you go through becoming a man. And I wanted to start sharing some thoughts and ideas with you, things that I've learned about ways of managing that. What might be a few suggestions we could give them or things we could teach them to do to help them channel that emotion, those feelings in the moment?
So the first thing that you want to do, regardless of the age of your son or daughter, is to help them label their emotions, right? So sometimes when we tell them what they may feel, that is useful, but it could be more useful for us to ask them how they feel and how they might describe it, and ask them how some of their friends feel at times, and ask them to describe it, and let them find a common language with you where they can articulate what emotional experience they or someone they know is having, and then you can help them label the word. And the reason why is because if you're then going to have management techniques, tools that you use, you want to agree on the language. You know, this is a tool you're going to use when you feel this way. So it's important to be able to identify the emotions in the first place. The tools are going to be unique to the individual, but when it comes to sort of managing that surge of testosterone that comes and goes and comes and goes through the whole process of puberty, which lasts many, many years, and then, you know, through the 20s and 30s, testosterone levels are quite high. They start to fall in the 30s, and then they're on sort of a slow decline through life, but they're certainly at their peak in the 20s. So the management tools are strategies that kids can use to offset the feeling of frustration or anger or whatever, you know, word they want to put on it that they're living. Often that is a physical outlet. So I'd say the most common tool that boys will use with great success is to go for a run, go shoot some basketball hoops, go do some jumping jacks and push-ups and pull-ups. Yet just offset that feeling with a cortisol rush that you get when you exercise and you get your heart rate up and you just shift. It really helps shift your mindset a bit to exercise and get that physical piece out. There are some kids for whom the physical is less important than the mental, the emotional. Those kids may choose to play music, to journal, to meditate. There are all sorts of strategies that kids will use to get that emotional sort of pent up feeling out without physically exerting themselves. The place that I don't really get, but boys have described to me in great detail, it helps. I just think I'm generationally off, and probably partly it's my gender because I'm not a gamer. There are lots of female gamers, but it's sort of a different mindset than mine, but some of them will game, and they will say they can get that feeling out through gaming as well. I just would caution parents who have boys who use gaming as an outlet to try to time limit that, because with physical exercise, your body will shut you down after a little while and tell you you're done. Gaming can go on sort of indefinitely in this culture, so we just have to help them wrap it up.
So we want them to use it if that's the way. And personally, I know, because it gets difficult and you have to monitor and it brings this parental piece to it, I would probably encourage them to, if that's what they come up with and say, this is what I like to do, say, great. And what else can you do? And encourage them to find other outlets. But it seems to me like gaming, they almost switch gears. It's like they get through letting that out, but then they get into something else, whether it's boredom or you're just in that zone. I mean, we've all binged on a Netflix show or something where it's right there. It's not like, ooh, I want to watch this. This is so interesting. It's almost just like, well, it's there. So you keep going. Or even
right.
As some kids get addicted. I mean, not every kid by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not saying don't let your kids game. I'm just saying that if they are spending years dealing with this testosterone and these feelings, that it's something, as you said, they need to be conscious of. So,
yeah, one really great strategy for parents is to help kids take an inventory of how their strategy worked. So if they were frustrated and they used some outlet, whatever that outlet was, and they did calm down, to then have a conversation afterwards. Okay, have that work for you? why, what was good about it, what wasn't good about it. And that helps kids kind of figure out over time what the most productive strategies are for them.
And that also, again, is another avenue that we're opening up conversations with our sons just about in general what's happening. Any last minute tips on that conversation piece? You know, you said we may run into resistance from the adult males in our life just because they don't necessarily see it the same way that we're seeing it now. We certainly, if we have a son who has chosen silence, you're likely to get some resistance there. So do you have any tips for parents who are listening, particularly moms who are listening, on having these conversations, on opening that door, on getting things, start getting the ball rolling on this?
Absolutely. So I tell everyone, when your child retreats behind a closed door, knock. You always want to knock. And insist on talking. And sometimes that talk means you go in and you sit down and you're face to face. Sometimes that talk is you sitting on the other side of the door because you don't want to look at each other right now. And so many conversations flow better when you don't look at each other. That's why the car works so well for conversations, because you're not looking directly at each other. This is a pattern, that kind of knock and go in and engage, that is, it takes practice. Sometimes you're going to get a lot of resistance. Eventually, if you keep at it and you keep insisting, I want to talk, I want to talk, I'm interested. And then you listen as a parent. You don't just talk at your child, but you actually listen to what he has to say. You will find that over time, he comes to you or he gives over a little bit. I have a lot of parents who say, my son has always talked to me and has continued to talk to me. And for those parents, I say that is a gift and you should enjoy every second of that gift. But I would also be willing to bet that if you really look closely, your son continues to talk to you, but he might talk to you a little bit less, or he might not talk to you about certain things that you realize you want to talk to him about. And so it isn't just for the parents of boys who are shutting them out completely. It's for parents of boys who are also shutting them out of certain corners of their life. You want to keep going there and just get used to the fact that conversations will be rejected. He will let you know when he is done. Sometimes he will stand up and walk away in the middle of a conversation, which is fine. Happens all the time. It's just par for the course. But it's just, you just keep going. You keep going because it's the repetition that demonstrates to your child that you care. And that is what opens the line of communication in the long run and keeps a really nice wide open avenue for once he has left the house and he is living an independent life and he still has you to come to engage in all these conversations.
And it's interesting because one of the things I've heard from mothers of boys as they go off to college is they really feel like they've lost them. And it seems to me now, in hindsight, that that was probably building through those high school years, that the boys were retreating behind those doors. And, you know, the moms didn't know how to bridge that gap or what to do and are trying to be supportive and respectful. And in that process, to some degree, I don't want to say lose them because I don't think they've lost them. It's just that now you need to build a new bridge and it's going to take some time, but you can do the same thing even if they're in their 20s, if they're at college or they've moved out into an apartment.
Sure. I mean, for those parents, and I hear that a lot too, to those parents, I say, tell your sons, I wish I had done this. I wish when you had shut your door, I had knocked on it every single time and come in and sat on your floor and had a conversation with you. And I didn't because I thought I was doing the right thing, but I'm going to do it now. And I'm just going to do it on the phone or virtually or by FaceTime or frankly, in the time of coronavirus, maybe they've moved back home and you can practice that skill now, you know, but it's never too late. It's never too late.
Okay. So just a quick recap. Talk. We need to talk to each other about what's going on with our boys. We need to talk to And when I say each other, I mean that we need to, moms need to talk to moms, dads need to talk to dads, parents need to talk to the other parent, spouses need to, partners, everybody needs to be talking the adult world. And we need to continue talking to our boys, even when they say, hey, I don't want to. We need to show up, and there's a little balance. I mean, we don't want to be in their face and going, you have to tell me what's wrong. It's what I heard you say was show up, knock on the door, say that, you know, hey, I'm here. I'm really interested. I really want to know what's happening with you and how you're feeling. And whatever their response is, just be calm and okay with it. And if they rage back, go, I get that. And I get that you're having some uncomfortable feelings right now. We can talk about that. And if you'd like a little time on your own to process it, you can do that too. But keep showing up and showing them love and respect. And remember that it's never too late. If you didn't do it in their teens, you can do it in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s and still have a relationship with your child. Just be honest, open, loving, and respectful. Kara, such a great conversation. And as I said, you know, I enjoyed your book, Decoding Boys, just really great information in there. So for any parents listening who want to find you, what is your website? Where can they get you online?
It is Worryproof MD. So Worryproof, M like Mary, D like dog.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for taking the time to get into this with us today. I so appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
And mighty parents, thank you for joining us here today. I know life is crazy, and so I always appreciate you, but I especially appreciate that you are taking the time to be with us here at this moment in history. If you have specific problems that you're dealing with, or you want to know something, whether it's related to the pandemic or it's just daily life or something that might be on hold right now, but you know is going to bite you in the butt once everybody gets back to normal life, pop me an email at connect@mightyparenting.com or go to the mightyparenting.com website in the podcast page for this episode. And you can also put a comment in there just letting me know where you are, how you're doing, what you need, and we'll try to continue to get that for you. So thank you for joining us today and being part of the Mighty Parenting community. Remember, you are a mighty parent. You got this, and I will see you next week.